You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Louise Beale. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we assess austerity in the UK as the British Chancellor gives his autumn statement. Be warned, it's grim reading.
Today's autumn statement hasn't done much to restore the UK to a sustainable growth trajectory, and that has negative implications for the whole of the European economy, with the UK a major part of that.
We'll hear which countries top the list of the most corrupt in this year's report from Transparency International.
Every country has some level of problem of corruption in the public sector, but where the majority of officials, or where the likelihood is very high that officials can get away with acts of corruption, that will just perpetuate the problem and it will even expand.
Plus, we'll hear how global warming may yet revolutionise the shipping routes to the east. Lots still to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up with all the latest news with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Rival demonstrators have clashed outside Egypt's presidential palace in the capital, Cairo, as unrest grows over a controversial draft constitution. Petrol bombs have been thrown, and President Mohamed Morsi's supporters have pushed down tents set up by anti-Morsi protesters. Vice President Mahmoud Mekki says a referendum on the draft will go ahead on the 15th of December, despite the unrest. But he's urging its critics to put their concerns in writing for future discussion. And US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has called on both sides to put aside their differences.
Ultimately, it is up to the Egyptian people to chart their way forward, but we want to see a process that is inclusive and a dialogue that is truly open to a free exchange of ideas that will further the democratic process in Egypt.
Israel has stepped up its proposals to build around 3,000 settler homes in one of the most sensitive areas of the occupied West Bank in defiance of international protests. A Defence Ministry official said architects and contractors have registered their plans for construction close to eastern Jerusalem. Israeli housing on the corridor's barren hills could cut off Palestinians from Jerusalem and further reduce their hopes for an independent state. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country is committed to a genuine and durable peace with their Palestinian neighbours.
For peace to endure, it must be a peace that we can defend. No other peace can survive in the Middle East. We remain committed to a negotiated settlement between us and our Palestinian neighbors. That solution is a two-state solution for two peoples, a peace in which a demilitarized Palestinian state recognizes the one and only Jewish state of Israel.
Rescue teams are searching for hundreds of people missing in the southern Philippines after the strongest typhoon this year killed at least 283 people. Typhoon Bopha, with gusts of up to 95 miles an hour, is weakening as it moves west, but it's left a trail of destruction, flattening farmlands and reducing homes to piles of rubble. Hardest hit was the southern island of Mindanao, where Bopha made landfall on Tuesday. The typhoon's triggered landslides and floods along the coast and in farming and mining towns inland. 300 people are missing. This military official says the authorities have a tough job.
We had to penetrate the area, debris in the road. Yun ang inuna namin, maklear yung area. And then, of course, the power shortage is one. And the communication problems, walang cell site, na functional in New Bataan, compounds the problem.
Reports are coming in of an explosion which has rocked a district in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. It's thought at least five people have been injured in the blast in Eastleigh, a mainly Somali neighbourhood. Last month, a grenade blast in Eastleigh left seven people dead. Despite showing signs it's emerging from the worst of its economic crisis, Ireland is facing new austerity measures. Irish Finance Minister Michael Noonan has announced Ireland's budget for 2013, saying the country must get back to a level which would fulfil the conditions of the EU IMF bailout package enabling it to borrow money from international lenders. Mr. Noonan's introduced tax increases and spending cuts worth up to 3.5 billion euros. The jazz pianist and composer Dave Brubeck has died, aged 91. The pioneering musician, most famous for Take Five and Blue Rondo a la Turk, sold millions of albums in the 1950s and 60s. He died on Wednesday morning in hospital in Connecticut. Brubeck played with Duke Ellington and Ella Fitzgerald. He would have turned 92 on Thursday. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. It is 5 minutes past the hour and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. As austerity continues to bite across Europe, it was the turn of the UK to feel the squeeze today. The UK's Chancellor, George Osborne, gave his autumn statement, and it doesn't make comfortable reading. Mr. Osborne is going to extend austerity measures in the UK to 2018 after missing debt-cutting targets he set himself. He had said the UK's debt would start falling as a proportion of GDP by 2015-16, but he's been forced to delay that target to 2018. Due to the state of the economy, which is worse than expected. In fact, it's expected to shrink by 0.1% this year. In a moment, we'll see how these provisions will affect the UK's position in the wider European community. But first, let's talk to Tony Drury, chairman of Axum Capital, a corporate finance house, author of the Drury Report on Small Business Finance, and blogger. Tony, welcome to the show. Good to have you with us. First of all, I mean, obviously, that sort of introduction only scratches the surface of this. But what does this really mean for the UK, the fact that we are going to be in austerity for longer than we had previously thought?
Well, I don't think anybody underestimates the difficulty of the job that the Chancellor of the Exchequer is facing. Our debt is 80% of GDP, so we do have a huge mountain to climb before we can begin to improve living standards in the UK. The questions really are, is he doing the right thing? If you've got too much debt, you can do one of three things. You can either cut expenditure, or you can increase revenue, or you can hope for a fairy godmother. And I don't think she's around. The government is mainly concentrating on cutting expenditure. And many of us feel that they're making a fundamental error. They should be concentrating on increasing revenues by encouraging corporate Britain to earn more. Taking one or two of the measures, the headline one is the cancellation of the 3p a litre rise in fuel duty. Now, that has to be welcomed. We are facing increased rates of inflation at the moment, which is very worrying. The Chancellor had no choice but to cancel this. What he hasn't said is that 3p a litre increase was built into our future revenues. So where's that money going to come from that he's now given up? That's one concern we have. A second concern, and I think this reflects people's worry about the coalition government, they're saying they're going to find $3.5 billion from saving in government departments. They've been in office for 2.5 years. How come there's another $3.5 billion to be saved? When the coalition started, they said they were cutting departmental expenditure by 25%. So what's happened in the last 2.5 years that they can now find another $3.5 billion? Things like that worry us. The 1% fall in corporation tax rate is to be very welcomed. The UK has very competitive corporation tax rates compared with the rest of Europe, and that's a start at encouraging companies to come over here and help us recover by increasing our earnings. So in summary, probably many of the things that are being done have to be done. We have to control as far as we can expenditure, but the basic weakness in this austerity budget is a lack of encouragement to increase revenue. Where are we going to encourage British companies to earn more money so that we have greater revenue and we can repay debt?
But Osborne himself says that the deficit is still falling and actually the cost of borrowing is falling as well. So he's sort of saying that he's on the right track. As you alluded to earlier, I mean, you know, he's stuck between a rock and a hard place in terms of really what the economy is like and what the outlook is. But is you're saying that he's not on the right path. What do you think he should be doing?
Well, it's not me who's saying that. It's he who's saying that. He's accepted he's broken his rules. He's not going to reduce the debt in the timescale that he said. Our earnings this year are in negative growth. He's reduced growth forecast for the next 3 years. So it's the Chancellor who's saying, I can't get the economy moving quickly enough. What we're suggesting is that there are measures that could be taken that could help him. We would like to see a much more active financial services market. You know that in London at the moment, the new issues market is dead. The main London markets, AIM, and the smaller markets are not putting companies and raising equity for them. That used to be a great source of earnings for the UK economy. So we do believe there are things that can be done that aren't being done.
OK, well, let's bring in Dr. Richard Wellings, Deputy Editorial Director of the Institute of Economic Affairs, who'll join me now to explore perhaps how this all might affect the UK's position in Europe. Dr. Wellings, thank you for joining us. And that's the point, really. I mean, what is this going to do to the UK's reputation in Europe?
Well, there's a major problem here, and that's that really the Chancellor hasn't done much to encourage long-term growth in the UK economy. So he was very quiet on issues such as deregulation, for example. We don't know whether the quite optimistic medium-term growth forecasts for the UK economy are going to be met. I mean, the Office for Budget Responsibility hasn't got a very good record in terms of forecasting over the medium term. So there's huge uncertainty, and obviously what's going on in the Eurozone doesn't help at all. So potentially the UK could have been really helpful for the wider European economy, being a motor of growth, but we haven't really seen much evidence that the Chancellor's promoting the kind of supply-side reforms that would produce that.
And do you think that the ratings agencies are going to react to this? I mean, could we see the UK being downgraded, and what kind of effect would that have?
I think that's a real risk looking ahead by a few months. So if the growth doesn't materialise, if we don't get this very strong growth from 2014 onwards, then yes, the bond markets are going to get a bit sort of edgy, and they could actually there could be some kind of downgrade. Unless, I mean, that's why I think there was a strong case for making further spending cuts. So you could have quite easily seen a big cut in foreign aid, which would have been popular with the public, and that would have made a difference. And also, lots of wasteful infrastructure projects that are on the cards could have been cut as well. So I think this is really a missed opportunity.
Tony, do you think that we're going to see the UK being downgraded, and if so, what kind of effect is that going to have?
I'm probably slightly more optimistic on that one. I mean, we have to accept the Eurozone is very weak indeed, and thus the pound is still quite a safe haven. So I think we probably, that the markets do like the policies George Osborne's following. As Dr. Wellings just said, the key is if we can get growth moving upwards, then I think we probably will retain our ratings.
And Dr. Wellings, I mean, what about going back to Europe again? I mean, obviously, Germany, the sort of powerhouse of Europe, have been very supportive of austerity and had perhaps supported the UK in its position and the tough stance that it was taking. Do you think that they're now going to shift their position and opinion of what the UK is doing?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, you've got to remember that it isn't really austerity is not really the right word for what's happened. So, I mean, overall the cuts have been quite modest. So we're looking at something like 3 or 4% of public spending being cut over a 4 or 5 year period, which is very small compared with what we've seen in some other European countries, particularly places like Romania or Estonia in Eastern Europe. So it's pretty small beer. But of course, the Germans have got their own problems, and the major threat for them is that they're going to be forced to bail out Southern Europe again and again and again. So that's where the real risk lies for them. So they're probably not that interested in what's going on in the UK.
And perhaps this is a little unfair question, but I want to ask you both. I mean, Tony, when it gets to 2018, I mean, what are your predictions for what kind of state the UK is going to be in?
Predicting that far ahead is mad. I struggle to predict a year ahead. Don't forget, we have an election. The next election is on the 7th of May 2015. Because of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, we have no choice now. We have a fixed term parliament. And you can well imagine that, as has been suggested, that the government's own spending plans are suggesting they're going to ease up in 2014, ready for the election, and then have a really severe period of austerity in 2016-17. So I just do not know what will happen in 2018. I mean, there is the other issue, which is not the question you're asking, so forgive me for mentioning it. But, of course, there is a thing called market cycles, and, of course, Hayek was the great economist for market cycles. There are some of us who believe that there is a natural buoyancy in cycles, and we may be towards the bottom, and the upturn may be a little bit nearer than we might think. It's all caused by the lack of liquidity. Excess is too much liquidity, and I'm afraid we had too much of that a few years ago. We have too little liquidity at the moment. Once the cycle starts to turn and confidence returns, retail spending increases, capital goods are bought, then, of course, the situation improves quite quickly. So it may be that there's a slightly better future ahead. And we, as Dr. Wellens is saying, we are one of the strongest countries in Europe. I think we should be proud of that position.
Richard Wellings, would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I agree particularly about the uncertainty points. And I think it's very dangerous to base your fiscal plans on these almost inevitably inaccurate growth forecasts. But there are reasons to be very negative about long-term growth. So the public sector is now huge, regulations increasing, huge rises in energy and transport costs due to environmental policies and carbon targets, as well as the ongoing crisis in the Eurozone. So huge uncertainty and reasons to be quite negative about the outlook.
Dr. Richard Wellings of the Institute of Economic Affairs and Tony Drury, author and corporate financier, thank you both very much for coming on the show. In a moment, we'll be back to assess which countries are top of the pile for transparency.
As 2012 draws to a close, Monocle has put together a selection of gifts that we'd like to find under the tree this year.
People of all ages turn to the teddy bear as the king of cuddly toys, and Shropshire's Merrythought is the firm to turn to. As the last remaining teddy manufacturer in the UK, its bears have become a sought-after collector's item. Opt for a classic Jackfield and an additional teddy bear picnic set, complete with a tartan blanket, miniature teacups and pots.
From portable coffee bean roasters to special edition parfum, you can find gift inspiration by watching our seasonal slideshow on monocle.com.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector, to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. If you're a government official in New Zealand or Denmark, well done you. Transparency International's latest annual Corruption Perceptions Index has named these nations as having the two most transparent governments in the world. For other countries like Afghanistan and Somalia, the results aren't so rosy. The organisation says 70% of countries still have significant corruption problems, despite many social, economic and political pushes to bring about change. Max Haywood, the regional coordinator for the Americas at Transparency International, explained the latest results to our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield earlier today.
What is it that New Zealand and Denmark are doing right that others should be following?
Okay, it's a really good question. So I think it's really important to emphasize that no country on this index actually scores a perfect 100. So even these countries which are at the top of the ranking only get 90 out of 100, meaning they still have some way to go. In general, what they're doing better than other countries is having more accountable institutions and more transparent information on what governments are doing. This makes it easier for citizens to monitor what their governments are doing and for journalists to monitor, for example, what budgets are being spent on. And at the same time, it makes it harder for people with, you know, intentions of enabling corrupt deals to access these budgets and use them for their own purposes. But it's important to emphasize that even in countries like Finland or Denmark, we still have evidence of issues, for example, revolving doors and lobbyists which are not well regulated. So they're not completely there yet.
It's interesting. I used to be based in Nairobi, and Kenya obviously has enormous corruption problems. And I was there when the MP's expenses scandal broke in the UK. And a number of people said, aha, see, look, you Brits, you're just as bad. You're corrupt. You have corrupt officials. Don't you lecture us. But to me, what the big difference there seemed to be that at least the MPs in Britain were being hounded out of office and in some cases going to jail.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the difference between, you know, having a system with a problem of corruption and a country where the corruption is the system. So exactly as you say, it's a question of scale, right? So if every country has some level of problem of corruption in the public sector, but where the majority of officials or where the likelihood is very high that officials can get away with acts of corruption, for example, misusing their expenditures, etc., that will just perpetuate the problem, and it will even expand because other people will get the same idea. They will see that no one is paying the price, right? So absolutely. Yeah.
How does a country, I mean, I'm not suggesting that Somalia can become anywhere like Finland, even within a generation, but how do those countries near the bottom rise up your rankings? Are there any countries over the last 10 or 20 years that you've seen make real progress?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. It's really good to see, actually, that it's getting increasingly difficult for us to talk about regional differences. So, for example, we have countries like Chile and Uruguay on our latest index from Latin America, who scored just above France or Austria. And we even have countries like Botswana, which is at the same level as Spain. So these are just a few isolated cases, but they're really good indications for the future. And what these countries are doing are things like, for example, making sure that they have free and fair elections, making sure that there are mechanisms for officials to be held to account. So, for example, that it's possible for journalists and for citizens to go online and see how they spent their budgets that year. You know, this generates multiple control points where it's much more difficult for officials to get away with corrupt behavior. So basically the answer is that if the decision is there to actually, the technology is already there. So what we're looking for is the decision to actually implement the technology to make budgets and government decisions more transparent, which would really go a long way to help in countries which are scoring quite low on the ranking, right?
Have you found that new technology has made things easier? I mean, we hear all the time about websites in India where you can report bribes or online platforms where people can track different allegations of corruption in different parts of a country. Have those things actually helped the fight against corruption?
Yes. I mean, I think absolutely these things are starting to make a difference. But even more than that, what I think it does is it changes the attitude of citizens. So when citizens as consumers, even in developing countries, now have access to the internet on their mobile phones, they have multiple options, they're used to having power in their hands. So it's getting increasingly difficult for governments to justify not sharing information and not making use of these technologies because citizens are asking, why are we not having the same access to our government as we do to global markets, for example? So the combination of technology plus citizen awareness, I think, is a very powerful one for the future to make governments more open.
That was Max Haywood of Transparency International speaking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Midori House with me, Louise Beale. Currently in Cannes, the elite of the world's luxury travel industry are rubbing shoulders and networking away at the invite-only international luxury travel market. With them is our contributing editor, Alicia Kirby, who's not only sniffing out where is the next big place to take a luxury holiday, but who's going and why. She's also got her finger on the pulse of what the latest trends are in the market and what's driving them. Alicia met up with Robert Cheng, Vice President for Marketing for the Peninsula Hotels, to hear how the family has become the focal point for certain hoteliers.
I think the days of luxury travel when it was just the parents and they leave the kids at home with the nanny are definitely over. You know, we see it at our hotels, and I think as you look around the booths and the ILTM here today, you definitely see many more hotels catering for families. And not only just having amenities for children or allowing the children to come, but actually creating special activities and menus for the kids. In Tokyo, in Chicago, and Shanghai, and across all our hotels, we actually have dedicated special representatives to really take care of the children and the young guests that we have at each of our hotels to create a more fun, educational, and entertaining experience for the whole family.
Because what kind of things are you actually implementing? As I understand it, you know, children actually decide where the next year's family vacation is going to be. So if they enjoy somewhere, they tell the parents, let's go back there, and that can actually be a deciding factor.
Well, I think the key, for us at least, is really to treat the children as adults and as VIPs in their own right. So we speak to them with proper respect. They have a complete check-in, check-out process. We've created special amenities for them. So, you know, in Beverly Hills, when we know we have children guests, you know, they have cookies and milk as opposed to a bottle of wine in the room just waiting for them. We have customized bathrobes for them and a whole host of activities, from a scavenger hunts around the hotel to kung fu classes and movie nights. So we really do try to use our creativity that we apply to our adult guests for children and make it kind of city appropriate, destination appropriate, and of course age appropriate as well.
What else can we kind of look forward to in the next couple of years? I mean, technology is obviously playing a big factor in the future of the hotel industry.
Well, we obviously have always been at the forefront of technology inside the hotels, but we obviously believe that the guest experience and the technology needs to be intuitive is critical. We don't want to use technology for technology's sake, but it has to be simple, intuitive, and easy to use. You know, we just pioneered the use of touchscreen tablets in the renovation of Peninsula Hong Kong, which debuted in September. The whole room is controlled by touch panels. But, you know, we've tested it and we've developed it in-house, so to make sure that it's simple and easy to use, and at the touch of a button you can control the entire room. We'd like to call it the world's most customized room, as it's, you know, we can customize it to the guest's language preferences. We can update information as it comes in, for example, weather or flight information. All of that is available at the touch of a button for all of our guests.
So as I understand it, you're the only hotel group in the world that develops its own technology, whereas other hotel brands choose to buy it off the shelf.
It's definitely a passion of ours, and we've had this, our electronic services department, for over 20 years. When you buy something off the shelf, you can't always have exactly what you want, and we know that our guests are very exacting and demanding, so we saw it as a priority. So we do have a James Bond-esque department in Hong Kong that really develops in-house technology, from the panels and the interfaces at the bedside panel to customizing our fleet of Rolls Royces to make sure that they have everything up to date with digital radio and Wi-Fi, even in our vintage 1932 Rolls Royces.
And what other kind of trends can we look to?
As you look around this show, you know, you see luxury spreading to further and wider places, which is fantastic. In the big cities where there are a lot of hotels, you know, you obviously see more hotels popping up and, you know, always claiming to be the next level of luxury. We think it's a great development for the hotel industry and for the hospitality industry as a whole.
And you can hear more from Alicia's adventures at the luxury travel market later tonight on the Monocle Daily. In a moment, we'll hear the latest news headlines from around the world. But first, here's Alice Gold with Cry, Cry, Cry. Alice Gold with Cry, Cry, Cry. In the next half hour of the programme, we hear how global warming could yet revolutionise the shipping industry. We'll examine the birth of the new Louvre in Lyon and check in with our New York Bureau Chief at the Double Design Arts events in Miami. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
Rival demonstrators have clashed outside Egypt's presidential palace in the capital, Cairo, as unrest grows over a controversial draft constitution. Petrol bombs have been thrown, and President Mohamed Morsi's supporters have pushed down tents set up by anti-Morsi protesters. Vice President Mahmoud Mekki says a referendum on the draft will go ahead on the 15th of December, despite the unrest. Israel has stepped up its proposals to build around 3,000 settler homes in one of the most sensitive areas of the occupied West Bank, in defiance of international protests. A defence ministry official said architects and contractors have registered their plans for construction close to eastern Jerusalem. Israeli housing on the corridor's barren hills could cut off Palestinians from Jerusalem and further reduce their hopes for an independent state. Rescue teams are searching for hundreds of people missing in southern Philippines after the strongest typhoon this year killed at least 283 people. Typhoon Bopha, with gusts of up to 95 miles an hour, is weakening as it moves west, but it's left a trail of destruction, flattening farmlands and reducing homes to piles of rubble. Reports have been coming in of an explosion which has rocked a district in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. It's thought at least 5 people have been injured in the blast in Eastleigh, a mainly Somali neighbourhood. Despite showing signs it's emerging from the worst of its economic crisis, Ireland is facing new austerity measures. Irish Finance Minister Michael Noonan has announced Ireland's budget for 2013, saying the country must get back to a level which would fulfil the conditions of the EU IMF bailout package, enabling it to borrow money from international lenders. The jazz pianist and composer Dave Brubeck has died, aged 91. The pioneering musician most famous for Take Five and Blue Rondo a la Turk sold millions of albums in the 1950s and 60s. He died on Wednesday morning in hospital in Connecticut. And those are the latest headlines from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London. It has up to 90 billion barrels of undiscovered, technically recoverable oil and over 1,000 trillion tonnes of natural gas. I am, of course, talking about the Arctic. And now a tanker carrying liquefied natural gas has become the first ship of its kind to sail across the Arctic. It managed to sail 6,000 miles through Russia's icy northern seas. Not only does this demonstrate how the warming of the Arctic, thanks to climate change, opening up new commercial shipping routes, but also how major oil and mining companies could soon be attracted to the region. Well, to discuss all the implications of this, let's talk to the Financial Times' energy correspondent Guy Chazan and David Metcalf, the CEO of Verdantix, the global environmental advisory group. Guy, if I can come to you first, this is, well, it's quite a feat, really, that this ship managed to make this journey. Just tell us a little bit more about what it actually did and the implications of it.
Well, it started off in Hammerfest, which is the northernmost town in the world. It's a town in the far north of Norway, where the Norwegian oil major Statoil has a big liquefied natural gas development called Snøhvit, or Snow White. So it picked up the LNG there, the liquefied natural gas, and it then went through the Barents Sea and across northern Russia, through the northern Russian seas to Japan. It was a very, very long journey, 6,000 miles plus. But it took this tanker much less time than it would have done if it had gone through the traditional route, which is, I suppose, through the Suez Canal and that way around. The company that actually owned the tanker, it's a Greek company called Dynagas. They say that it shaved something like 40% of the journey time off doing it along this route. So it really makes economic sense for companies to do this, even though they actually had to hire a nuclear-powered icebreaker to accompany them on the journey.
I was going to say, you need a pretty serious boat to do that, don't you? I mean, what does this mean in terms of shipping? Because if this can be done and continue to be done, then obviously that could really change the whole face of shipping in the world.
Well, it creates a new route, basically, and it's a route which is increasingly popular. Apparently, the volume of commercial traffic through this Northern Sea route has been multiplying in recent years. I mean, obviously, 5-10 years ago, there were no ships plying this route because it's just too hazardous, and also because of the extent of sea ice, it was actually, there are very few days in the year when you could actually physically do it, but because that wind has sort of been growing due to climate change and the effects of global warming, which are melting the polar ice cap. It's actually easier to do the route now than it has been in the past, and that is obviously opening up a lot of commercial opportunities for shipping companies.
And also, I suppose, commercial opportunities about, you know, just for gas and oil, like I was mentioning a little bit earlier, because there are enormous number of natural resources in the Arctic. And I suppose if you can get there more easily, then all of that kind of plays into each other.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, Russia, for example, has enormous resources within the Arctic Circle. They have enormous gas fields onshore in places like the Yamal Peninsula in the far north of Russia, and also offshore in the Barents Sea. There's a field called Shtokman, which is one of the largest in the world. And if they can actually start to develop those fields and liquefy the gas that they produce there for export, then potentially that gas can now be shipped through their northern seas to Japan, which would be hugely lucrative for Gazprom, the Russian energy giant, and for the Russian treasury.
And now, if I may turn to you, David Metcalf, just obviously the implications of that on the environment are not good at all, are they?
Well, it's a very complex situation because what we've seen in our research that's happening in the Arctic is that, I guess, businesses have moved into this phase of what we call climate change exploitation. So, yes, there are organizations saying we need to reduce our emissions because of what's happening with climate change. But there are others that are saying, well, this is creating these new opportunities. And the first phase of this in the Arctic is definitely going to be around building out transport infrastructure, but also things like laying subsea cables. And that is going to permit changes in shipping, as we've just heard, but also more drilling for oil and gas. I think one has to be careful not to say, sort of fall into the trap of saying this is all bad, because clearly if you are taking 40% off the shipping route through going more directly, that is actually reducing CO2 emissions. So it's not as complex as saying this is all bad for the environment, but clearly from a environmental kind of campaigner's point of view, as you see certainly the likes of Greenpeace protesting, there are issues around, I guess, the sort of hypocrisy, if you like, of oil and gas firms exploiting the climate change that many would say they've created.
What about sort of investors? I mean, should they be treading carefully anyway? Because I suppose the Arctic economy is fairly unpredictable. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be at the mercy of climate change, I suppose, possible conflicts, policy changes, and then obviously the public opposition that you've alluded to there. Is it sort of perhaps quite a risky place?
Certainly from our point of view, just to start with, you have issues around the applicability of the law of the sea, and the Arctic economy to some extent is governed by a non-binding group called the Arctic Council. So as we saw with some years ago, the Russians planting their flag underneath the North Pole, there is in a way what we described as an ice rush as governments and companies try to take a piece of the action. But they will face a whole range of risks, and that is why you've seen some organizations like the French oil and gas group Total come out a couple of months ago and say, from our point of view, we're not willing to get involved. Some of these risks are simply that the impact of climate change is very unpredictable. So you can't actually have a permanent plan to reroute all of your shipping, because you may actually find that the sea ice is much more extensive next summer as opposed to this summer. You still have very harsh physical conditions. Melting sea ice doesn't actually change the fact that, of course, in the winter it's going to be dark for a long period of time. And also we've seen things like shale gas in the US has actually made the business case for some oil and gas exploration projects no longer viable.
Okay, David Metcalf, CEO of Verdantix, the Global Environmental Advisory Group, and the Financial Times' energy correspondent Guy Chazan, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this to hear how the Louvre is opening an outpost in the north.
Monocle's third annual Soft Power Survey is an attempt to push the debate on where soft power comes from and how to use it. And with current shifts in the global power balance, never has it been more relevant.
The unofficial yet undisputed leader of Europe relies on the strength of its business brands. While Angela Merkel has been hesitant to do what is necessary to drag the continent out of its economic malaise,
Germany has just about enough in its soft power arsenal, from the Goethe Institute to the popularity of its football league, to keep it near the top.
From culture to sport, cuisine to diplomacy, find out which countries are best at wielding their weapons of soft power by watching our countdown in the programmes menu on Monocle.com. You're listening to Midori House. For art lovers, the long-awaited opening of the Louvre's new outpost in the northern French town of Lens can't come soon enough. But they're not the only ones waiting to see how it fares. The project has cost 150 million euros to build, and it's been heavily backed by the local region, who've put up 60% of the finance. They're hoping the gallery will boost the local economy of this struggling industrial mining town. More than 200 works will be installed from Paris, and there will be large-scale exhibitions twice a year. Curators are hoping the gallery will mimic the success of the Guggenheim Bilbao and the Pompidou Met, which had over 500,000 visitors last year. So with just a week to go until it opens its doors, can it do just that? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Annette Young, a journalist based in Paris for France 24. Annette, thank you very much for joining me. So I suppose that is the first question, really. Will this project work?
Well, that's the question on everybody's lips, but you sort of understand why they've done it, because obviously it's a trend now for big art establishment institutions to go down this path of opening up franchises, if you like, in places which you wouldn't necessarily associate with art galleries as such. In this case, it's a very depressed area of the country. It's an area that was renowned for its coal mining industry, but the last coal mine shut down in 1986, and ever since then, it's been on a sort of spectacular demise, and certainly this current world economic downturn hasn't done it any favours. I mean, the statistics speak high for themselves. I mean, the fact is it's high unemployment, it's somewhere at 24%, which is sort of well above the national average of 9%. It's a city or a town, rather, where you see many closed-up shops. It's certainly a very depressed area, but that is exactly why they picked it. The management, they've argued that this is exactly what this sort of area needs, a massive pickup. This will be something that will become a tourist must-see destination, and not surprisingly, the local authorities are very supportive.
I'm sure they are, but, I mean, the point is, if the tourists come, then yes, it will help, but is there anything else there for them to see? I mean, are you going to have to make a special trip? Are people going to come from Paris out there to see it? Or how are they going to get people there?
Well, this is the big argument against such a decision, because a lot of people are pointing out this town is not renowned for being a transport hub, and why is it that the Louvre had decided to pick this area as opposed to somewhere like Aix-en-Provence, which is a very well-known town in the south of France where already hundreds of thousands of tourists already visit, and also is well connected by train, bus and plane. This is certainly not the case with this particular part of the country. However, they argue that won't be a major problem, it won't be an obstacle as such, and that the location itself will mean many will make that effort to go and visit that part of the region. If they do, we'll have to wait and see. But they're expecting, to attract hundreds of thousands of visitors, and to have, as she pointed out earlier, the effect that the Guggenheim Bilbao Museum had in that part of Spain at the time, which was also a very highly depressed region.
Well, fingers crossed then it does work. I suppose one of the ways that they look like they're planning on doing this is making it quite different from the Louvre in Paris, aren't they? I mean, I know they're having a number of pieces coming over, but then they're going to do two big exhibitions a year in a very large space. Is that the sort of thing that they're going to be doing to try and make it a bit different so it gives people an extra reason to visit?
Absolutely. And, it's a modern space. It's more based, as they say, on the design of the Louvre Pyramid, which you would be familiar with, that glass pyramid designed by A.M. Pei, which is at the front of the classic Louvre building. And it's very open, it's very modern. The inside apparently is very impressive, with two sprawling exhibition spaces where they're hoping to display, among many items, Egyptian statues, 11th century Italian church mosaics, and Leonardo da Vinci's restored masterpiece, the Virgin and Saint Anne. But some would argue in the art world that's all very well and good, but that's a very Parisian elitist way of dealing with art, and in that you're sort of taking it to this sort of godforsaken place and sort of superimposing it on the local people as such. And in fact, what the art establishment in Paris should be doing instead is trying to get those people from not only just the provinces, but say, for instance, the outer suburbs of Paris to come into Paris itself and visit the existing museums, which, you know, and I mean, it's a reflection of the ongoing debate going on in France at the moment, but the sort of growing divide between those who have and those who have not, and the fact that many believe that the urban elite in Paris, have sort of, there's a disconnect as such, and that they feel that this sort of decision to plonk a museum of this nature in the middle of a, you know, depressed region in France basically says it all in terms of, you know, is this in fact going to generate jobs, which is what that part of the country needs more than anything else.
But is this a trend that we're seeing? Because you mentioned it earlier about the Guggenheim Bilbao, but this sort of franchising of galleries, is this something you think perhaps we'll see more of?
Yes, and certainly it's clear we've seen that with the MoMA, we've seen it with the Guggenheim. I mean, clearly art establishments are having to sort of think carefully and cleverly about how do you move forward in the 21st century, how do you take art out to the people as such, and to be creative in thinking about, you know, new spaces and going to places that people would never normally associate with art. But again, I think at this time where money is very, very tight, this decision has caused a fair degree of consternation as to was it a smart move, given that, you know, this is a part of France which, as I just said earlier, you know, the last time there was any serious industry in that part of the country was back in 1986 when the last coal mine closed. You know, is this really going to do what is needed? Some in the local authorities argue yes, because, you know, with tourism comes jobs. Others are arguing no, that's going to take quite some time, and given that, you know, it's not a well-connected place in terms of transport, that people are being way too optimistic about the estimations of who, in fact, is going to take a hike out into the countryside and go to Lens to visit the Louvre.
Annette, will you be one of those people, though? Are you going to take a hike out into the countryside and go and have a look?
You put me on the spot. Maybe when the weather is better.
Okay, well, you'll have to let us know your thoughts when you get back. Annette Young, journalist based in Paris for France 24, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back after this. In a moment, we'll be heading to Miami, where there's not one but two major art and design events taking place. But first, let's have some music. This is The Glimmers, and Let's Get Physical. That was The Glimmers and Let's Get Physical. You're listening to Midori House with me, Louise Beale. We fly now to ever sunny Miami, where our New York Bureau Chief Aisha Spears is braving the wilds of Design Miami and the Miami Art Basel. Good afternoon, Miami, and how is it there today?
It's very balmy. It's a little overcast, which I think means a lot of the Miami girls who aren't wearing too many clothes are probably a bit sad, but I'm wearing a coat still from New York, so I'm pretty happy it's not too sunny.
Okay, good. Well done. And I gather you've literally just stepped off the plane. But as we were saying, two major events going on. Let's talk about Design Miami to start with. Tell us about this.
Indeed. So I got off the plane about 2 hours ago, and I went straight from the airport to an event that's kind of on the satellite end of Design Miami, called Architecture for Dogs, which is a Kenya Hara envisioned thing of all these amazing architects and designers from around the world designing bits and pieces for basically dog furniture. That was quite fun. Design Miami and Art Basel, I'll be hitting both of those tomorrow. They're both on South Beach. And this whole city, especially South Beach and the Design District, it gets taken over by this fair. So everyone's in town for about a week or so. And alongside, obviously, wherever there's art, there's a lot of kind of luxury brands doing events. So Chanel has a big event tonight. Louis Vuitton are displaying a kind of art collaboration they're doing on Friday. And then on top of that, I'll be seeing a few people who are either artists or gallery owners. I'm about to go see Simon Dupuy from the Auction House this afternoon to talk about why they're down here.
Wow, so a lot going on. And does the whole place feel sort of kind of buzzing, I suppose, if there's that much going on and so much focus on Miami?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm on Collins Avenue right now, which is kind of the strip that you would imagine when you think of South Beach and Miami Beach. So it's got this Art Deco, very colourful buildings. There's people going around on Segways, lots of muscle t-shirts. But then contrasting to that, you've got these flyers for Art Basel and Miami Beach, which is sponsored by UBS. So it's this kind of corporate beach lifestyle, which I think a lot of people in the middle, early December, coming from Europe, coming from New York, from colder places, it's quite a nice week to spend in the sun and go and buy some art.
So out of the two events, I mean, what are the highlights expected to be for both of them?
I think it's just going to be all the big galleries. I haven't gone into the shows yet, so I'll be able to tell you more over the next couple of days. There's some public art going on, so there's a lot of public art on the beach tonight, some films, some video art, and there's also a plane, which I'm trying to spot, which they've got a lot of planes that fly the beaches here with ads. You know, they sort of have those tag-along things, and they've turned those into art pieces, so all sorts of artists have curated these things that go on the back of those propeller planes that go along the beach. So the public art aspect, I think, will be quite interesting, and then I'll go and look at the actual exhibitions tomorrow.
And what do normal kind of Miami people think of it all? I mean, particularly, as you say, if you've got the planes and stuff and there's all this art there, I mean, I've got visions of Miami Beach of people sort of like in tiny bikinis or whatever and doing exercises and flexing their muscles. I mean, is this their kind of scene? And, you know, how do they respond to it all?
Well, there's definitely, over the last few years, a more permanent base of kind of art collectors and art galleries and design stores has set up in Miami because of the influence of Art Basel and Design Miami. So the Design District, there are, you know, beautiful stores from Poltrona Frau to Casino, all those kind of companies are here. But then you do have this kind of nice clash between that and the beach culture. I assume local Miami people like it because it's bringing in a lot of money and a lot of attention into town. Miami is a party town, so I'm sure through the year there are all sorts of excuses for people to come down here and party.
Well, I hope you can be one of those people who can join in the party as well. And I hope it gets a little bit warmer so you can take your coat off too, or that you're not too hot at the moment. But our New York Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears, thank you very much for joining us. I'm afraid that is about all we have time for today on Midori House. Thank you very much to our producer, Aled John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey, who's wearing a very lovely Christmas jumper, but sadly you can't see that. Next up is The Entrepreneurs, where we'll find out about the upcoming trends in the global hotel industry. And in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Robert Bound and Tamsin Smith will be back for the Monocle Daily. Hugo MacDonald will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.